0.4 dB, 0.41 dB. The program would write down that number. When you get below that, it flips over to exponential mathematics. In this case, the answer was 5.16 e minus 2 dB. E means exponential. Minus 2 means move the decimal places, move the decimal place 2 points to the left. So 5.16 e minus 2, when you move it 2 places to the left, your answer becomes 0.0516 dB. So maybe you hadn't seen exponential mathematics in a case like this. And is that a possible explanation why it was confusing at first, Joe? Go ahead.
Just say it so they tell me what the minus 2 is. Now I understand what they're saying when they do that. Okay. Now I get it.
Okay. I think we got a happy camper here, Mel. We have to send another bill out. Do you have a further question, Joe? K2LYY, K2LYW?
Yeah, actually I did, but I guess I'll let it wait for next week with the question on TV, because I'd rather be more quiet for me if I can, call you comfortably, okay?
Okay, let's wait and find out if we got anyone else signing in. If not, we're going to come back and query you for more questions, if you know what I mean. Okay, you guys are listening to TechNet number 1214. I am guessing by now the interview on 60 Minutes with Barack Obama is over. So you guys have come back to the rig, and maybe there's some more people to sign in. This is the TechNet with K2KEY and Mel. Anyone else have any questions, give me your call letters and name, and the confirming yes, meaning you do have a question or comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
KC2QIQ and yes.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else?
Kilo Charlie 2 Delta Echo Papa, just monitoring the net.
Okay, Mr. DEP is just out, is monitoring. Glenn, you got it.
Yeah, actually, Dick, my question is something picking up on a discussion we were having a couple of days ago at lunchtime about balance. And I know I've built quite a few in different configurations, but one thing that always confuses me, especially is the definition and balance of between what they call current fed balance and voltage fed balance. And what exactly does that mean? And I believe what actually defines a current fed balance as opposed to a voltage fed balance? And hopefully if you answer that one, I have a second question backing that one up from a couple of different types that I've built in the past.
That's a darn good question you've asked, Glenn. And I'm one of the guys who only had partial understanding of that a few months ago. I've recently, in the last couple of months, done a whole lot of research on that. And my motivation for doing the research is that my main client, I run a consulting business, my main client I'm working with, I'm designing 915 megacycles antennas for him, and we know we needed a balancing function. We're designing lots of antennas that squeeze into small places, and sometimes the antenna itself is unbalanced. In other words, if I had a pure dipole, but because of the room that's left over in a handheld package where the dipole's got to go, half the dipole has got more capacitive loading to the printed circuit board than the other half. So you've got an unbalanced dipole, very similar to what happens when you have an off-center fed dipole. The so-called Wyndham dipole is a dipole that's off-center fed. And if you take a look at the latest issue of QSC Magazine, the December issue, and I think it was in Hints and Kinks. Nope, wait a minute now. The latest issue of QEX, Experimenters Exchange of ARRL, just arrived a couple of days ago. There's an article in there about off-center feeding a dipole of a driven element of a 2-meter Yagi antenna. And let me drop for a minute and tell you why you do that. The dipole in the center, a pure thin wire dipole in free space, it's got something like 73 ohms of resistive impedance when you choose the right length that is resonant. And the right length that's resonant is a little bit shy of half wavelength mechanically. But you're establishing electrical resonance when you make it a tiny bit shorter. There's always a little bit of in loading capacitance on every real dipole. It's just the way Mother Nature behaves. When you make the dipole out of a larger diameter piece of tubing, the impedance comes down a little bit. Maybe instead of 73 ohms, it's 54 ohms. When you put that dipole in the middle of a Yagi, the center impedance of that dipole now becomes something more like 20 ohms because of the way the parasitic elements behave. And that's a function of your particular Yagi design. So each Yagi design for each length has a slightly different impedance that the driven element will experience. So if you fed it in the center, it'd have to match 20 ohms. If you could off-center feed the driven element, as you stop, not feed it in the center, but you feed it more and more off to one side, the impedance goes up. And so there's a magic position along the length of that dipole. If you feed it there, off-center feed, you'll find the 50 ohm point. And so this article in QEX shows you how to do that. You literally plug the coax cable into the center of the tubing of the driven element, and then you walk that coax cable down the tubing until you hit the right location, and then you create a break in the tubing at that point, put in an insulating device, shield goes to the main portion of the dipole, semiconductor goes to the little dip that's left over, and now you're off-center feeding the dipole in a thoroughly shielded manner. Cute idea. So, in that case, you're creating a balance by a very peculiar process, by the way you feed the coax cable down the semiconductor. And so, he doesn't need a real balance. He's using the dipole simultaneously as an off-center fed, impedance-shifted thing, and balance simultaneously. So I shouldn't have gone there, but I'm just telling you that's one possible solution. But let me go back to my particular case. If I had a pure balancing device, and we were using voltage balance, the voltage balance we used, you took the shield of the coax and you ground it to the printed circuit board. You took the center conductor and you made a tiny little T out of wire for the center conductor. You fed the right hand side and the left hand.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You fed the right hand side and the left hand side of the dipole. What we were doing, because we were trying to feed a 50 ohm load in a balanced manner, we had on the right hand side of the T coming from the center conductor, we had a series inductor in a shunt capacitor, and we chose the right LC ratio so that it became 25 ohms of load. So we had a series L and a shunt C to the right. We had a series C and a shunt L to the left, the opposite, but again 25 ohms. So the right-hand LC gave us plus 90 degrees of phase shift and 25 ohms of output impedance. The left-hand LC network gave us 25 ohms of output impedance and a leading phase of 90 degrees. So leading phase to the left, lagging phase to the right. Therefore, between the two 25 ohm load outputs, 25 ohms left, 25 ohms right, if you connected between those two outputs a 50 ohm resistor, you would be feeding the 50 ohm resistor in a thoroughly balanced manner and a thoroughly impedance match manner at the center frequency. That was a voltage balance. Those divider LC networks, one to the right and one to the left, were forcing a particular voltage at a particular phase angle, you could say forcing a particular impedance, to ground to the right and to the left. Feed a thoroughly balanced floating 50 ohm load with that voltage balance I just described to you, everything's hunky-dory. If all of a sudden the load happens to be a 50 ohm dipole, but the dipole itself is unbalanced, the dipole has got more capacitance to ground on the left-hand side than the right-hand side. In that circumstance, this voltage balance, a circuit that forces a certain voltage, becomes unhappy. It becomes mismatched. You end up with a reflection coefficient. In our particular environment, we're trying to tune for extremely small reflection coefficients. We want extremely good impedance matches across the frequency range. So that circuit, that balance that forced a voltage, did not work well. Now let me give you an example of how I could make a current balance out of this, and I'll show you why we couldn't do it at first. Let me drop. Now, if I had an ideal one-to-one transformer, where I had the exact same number of turns on the primary and the secondary, maybe it's a toroid, and if I had 50 ohms of input impedance and 50 ohms of output impedance between primary and secondary of the transformer, you would think that would solve the problem beautifully. In the case of the primary winding, one end of the winding would be grounded, the other end would go to the center conductor of the input coax cable. The output secondary winding of this one-to-one transformer could now feed my dipole, let's assume it's a 50 ohm dipole, and because the secondary winding of the transformer is thoroughly floating with reference to ground, as long as my antenna has between the two terminals a floating impedance of 50 ohms, everything's hunky-dory. And because the transformer secondary winding is thoroughly floating, even if the dipole 50 ohm load is an unbalanced load, more capacitance on one side than the other, the floating characteristic of that secondary winding would accommodate it. So although this is not exactly the definition of a current balance, that circuit I just described to you would act like a current balance. It is forcing the right amount of impedance match between the two output terminals, the right amount of voltage, but I could make the load itself unbalanced any way I want to. I could ground the left-hand side of the dipole. I could ground the right-hand side of the dipole. Because the winding that's feeding it is thoroughly floating, it would readjust, and therefore it acts like a current balance. It is thoroughly isolated from ground, but presiding the right differential impedance. So now let me come up with my definition of a current balance. A current balance is one in which the differential impedance between the two output wires is clearly defined. In my case, 50 ohms. The common mode impedance between those two wires, I'd like it to be infinity. And that's exactly how I measured the quality of current balance. I adjusted the transformer to be a one-to-one transformer. I knew I had 50 ohms of input. I forced 50 ohms of output by putting, let me drop, the tiniest surface mount 50 ohm resistor I could find between the two output leads. And now the two output leads were thoroughly matched. I could measure the standing wave ratio on the input side of this transformer, and it was a low number at the first frequency where I did the test. I'll explain that in a minute. So now, the transformer is thoroughly matched by the floating 50 ohm tiny surface mount resistor. Then, with another piece of coax cable grounded to the printed circuit board, shield grounded to the board, I took the center conductor of that second piece of coax cable, which was part of the cable coming into the J1 port of a network analyzer, and I referenced the network analyzer to the open end of that piece of coax cable by putting shorts, opens, and modes, and whatever. I told the network analyzer that the end of that piece of coax cable, the secondary piece of coax cable I've got on the board, very near the 50 ohm floating resistor, I calibrated to the end of that line. Now, as I said before, shields are shorted to ground. I connected the center conductor to one end of the 50 ohm resistor. If the transformer as a current balance was perfect, the network analyzer would show me a dot on the far right hand side representing infinite impedance, because that's my calibration point, Smith chart display. It showed infinite impedance on the right hand side before I connected the center conductor of that secondary piece of coax cable to the 50 ohm resistor. Then I connected it to the floating 50 ohm resistor, and the movement on the network analyzer was so small that when I figured out what it meant that my particular current balance was acting like 0.2 of a picofarad at 915 megacycles. It was 1450 ohms of common mode impedance, and whether I fed the right hand side of the floating 50 ohm resistor or the left hand side didn't matter. Or even if I shorted the 50 ohm resistor itself, I still measured 1450 ohms with the current balance I eventually discovered. Now, in order to make it understandable, I used in this example a real primary secondary transformer with real windings, and mini circuits make such a device, and I tried it. In this application, the application didn't work well.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The reason it didn't work well is two reasons. One, ferrite at 915 megacycles, the winding, the magnetic core of the transformer, 915 megacycles is a very high frequency, and ferrite has pretty poor response up there. It's kind of lossy, kind of leaky, kind of yucky. Second of all, the primary and secondary winding of the transformer had a hell of a lot of stray capacitance between primary and secondary, and a lot of stray capacitance between the turns itself. So the real transformer up there didn't work well. But if you take a look at the mini circuits catalog, and you take a look at the TCLM1-11, I think is the name of their transformer. They make a one-to-one transformer, which is wound very differently. Doesn't have a clearly defined primary and secondary. I'll have to describe that to you later. But that's the one where I got this result I'm looking for. I wanted the output impedance differentially to be carefully defined at 50 ohms in my case, and I wanted the floating common mode impedance to be high. I did get that 1,450 ohms. I got it with this Tracy transformer I'm starting to describe to you. I thought I would get that with the real primary secondary transformer because of the straight capacitances. I did not. So maybe this gives you a little bit more feeling for what is a current balance versus a voltage balance. When you Google the word current balance and voltage balance, you'll find a whole bunch of articles by Unideller and other people that sort of give you a hint for what's going on, but they don't give you a clearly defined definition of what is a current balance. With all the words I just gave you, maybe you got a little bit more of a feeling for it, and now you know what I was trying to do here, Glenn. And maybe this will it'll help you in your particular application. KC2, QIQ. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2KY with a comment.
Now, hold on there, Glenn. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I've been asked this question so many times, and the best way to explain it, I found. In fact, I was asked on field day, we were putting up the beam, and I have on the beam the calls for this, what is known in the schematic or the assembly of beam, they tell you to create a common mode choke. Now, what is a common mode choke? It is several turns of the coax cable that you roll up and you hang right there, tape it right there next to the, on the mast at the driven element. So what actually is happening is, I think the easiest way to explain it, when you roll this coax into this sort of coil, and without, it does not have any ferrite or anything like that in it, what happens is that you are creating a situation where the current inside the coax are unaffected by the coil configuration. So what happens is the common mode current trying to flow on the outside of the coax are, or the braid of the coax, we actually say they are choked off. So this is basically one of the simplest examples of a common mode choke, or what we would say basically could be considered a current balance, Dick. Over.
Good explanation. And I'm going to ram it home a little bit further. Where do you use an RF choke? Say, for instance, I want to put B-plus onto the plate of a transmitting tube. And if I just ran a wire from the power supply up to the transmitting tube, when there's RF on that plate circuit, it's going to go roaring back into the power supply. By putting an RF choke, maybe 2.5 millihenry in some cases, which has thousands of ohms of inductive reactance at your operating frequency. But that RF choke might have a DC resistance of 1 ohm. So with 1 ohm worth of voltage drop, very little, your 300 volts from your power supply through the RF choke is being applied to the plate. And the plate's happy. He's got his B plus voltage. But the RF voltage on the plate, the signal it's generating, can't get back to the power supply because the choke has got such an inductance that it acts like thousands of ohms of inductive reactance. The current flow can't flow back. So with the coil of coax cable Mel was talking about when he feeds his dipole, the coil, the multiple turns of the coax on the shield, is a great big coil. It's a poor man's RF choke. It has thousands of ohms of impedance at your operating frequency if you've got enough turns and enough diameter taped together. So the current that wants to flow down the outside of the coax cannot. It gets choked off. But the real signal you and I care about is flowing down the center of the coax, and the signal going down the center doesn't know what's going on in the outside world. Doesn't know he's going through a couple of turns of the coil. All he knows is going through a little bit longer piece of coax. And if it's low enough loss, it doesn't make any difference. So differentially, the voltage between center conductor and shield on the inside of the coax, that comes roaring out of the end, feeds your dipole, and the dipole's happy. But any current that wants to flow back gets choked by that coil. That's another example of a beautiful current balance. What if it's starting to make a little more sense here, Glenn? KC2, QIQ, K2LIW.
Yes, it does, Dick. And thanks also for the explanation there, too, Mel. What I guess really threw me off is I've been building balance now for about the last 3 years on most of my outdoor wire antennas and getting the match as close to the antenna as possible before feeding it into coax. And in some cases, from the dipole part, maybe running a piece of ladder line down away from the dipole or the loop antenna, and then, you know, attaching the balun before I attach the coax before it comes through the shack. And what I've basically been doing was creating isolation or total galvanic isolation on frequencies below 10 megahertz. And by winding transformers at high frequency using ferrite, 2,500 perm materials. And it actually, it's a shame we didn't talk earlier, Dick, on this subject, because I have a couple of ferrite coupled transformers now working in excess of 2 gigahertz, where my insertion loss into 2 and 4 to 1 mismatches, or, to different loads, and vice versa going down in the other direction, are less than, maybe an eighth of a dB, between a quarter and eighth of a dB of total loss, which, in my opinion, I think is pretty phenomenal. And the way I've been achieving that is by attaching bobbins over some dielectric material over the core to isolate the core, then using some kind of like a dielectric tape, like a very high temperature capped on tape, then winding the primary and the secondaries in on a single layer across the bobbin material, and then checking the match on either end by terminating SMA connectors or type N connectors on either side very, very close, and then mounting it into a totally enclosed metal structure, KC2 QIQ.
I'm going to have to query you some more on this. The fact that you're using ferrite as a core and making balance out of it, and I have the impression from what you're saying, the signal is really flowing through the ferrite, and you're doing it at 2 gigahertz, and you're getting an eighth of a dB of insertion loss. I'm amazed by that. All the ferrite that I could find in a real primary secondary transformer at 900 megacycles running in the milliwatt level, I had numbers like 8 tenths and a dB of insertion loss. And at 2 gigs, I think the stuff would really have lost. I got around that by choosing this current balun made by Minicirc. It's a beautiful little thing that's only, I think it's 120,000th of an inch cube with nice little solder leads on it. When you study the way this current balun works, let me explain this one to you. Make believe that I've got two wires, a red and a green wire, enameled wire, and I've got them twisted together, and that as a twin lead transmission line, they're close to 50 ohms. Doesn't have to be, but it's in the neighborhood of 50 ohms. If it was 70, it's close enough for this application, because you're going to use a very short length of it. So I've got twisted pair, let's call it 50 ohms. And the two input wire, on one side, red and green, I'm going to call it the primary input. And now the twisted pair, I'm going to wind them on a toroid, let me pick a number, 5 times. So the twisted pair gets wound on a toroid 5 times. The output end of the green and red wire are now the two floating leads. Because it's wound on the toroid 5 times, it's very similar to Mel's 5 turns of coax cable on his poor man's balance for feeding his dipole. It's an RF choke. So differentially, the impedance between the red and green wire stays 50 ohms, going through the twisted pair, through the multiple turns, and coming out. But because it's got multiple turns, it's got inductance, and it happens to be wound on a piece of red ferrite. Stand by. And now that particular device, in its miniature form, with very small wire, I don't know, maybe it's 26 gauge wire. The total thing at 915 megs has got 4 tenths of a dB insertion loss, which I can tolerate, and gives me this rather nice, not perfect, but good enough current balance function. Floating output, got RF choke. And as I check that red ferrite that the mini circuits used with a magnet, it is non-magnetic material. It looks like ferrite, but it's red in color under a microscope, and I'm not convinced it's ferrite at all. It may be a piece of ceramic. It's just a coil form. I'm not sure, but that's what it might be. But it does the job. So it doesn't have a real primary and secondary. It doesn't have the straight capacitance problem that a primary and secondary would have. I have the impression of what you put into your shielded box at 2 gigs really was a toroid wound primary and secondary winding with some kind of a capped-on insulating tape between the primary and the secondary to lower the capacitance. And so maybe your coupling is occurring directly from primary to secondary because of that one is wrapped over the other, and maybe it's not using the ferrite at all. The fact that you're getting an eighth of a dB of insertion loss at 2 gigs with ferrite leads me to believe that not much of the signal is flowing into the ferrite, otherwise I think you'd get a lot more loss. I don't know if anyone has invented ferrite that works that well at 2 gigs yet, but maybe you found some. in which case I'm going to want to know what brand name and where did you get it and what it cost. KC2QIQ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I actually use ferrite and VHF and UHF, no problem at all. The key is to get enough number of turns. The idea is that you have to get enough turns on it initially to reduce the flux, the peak flux in material at the power that you're going to be operating to a low enough, infinitesimally small area. And when you're talking about VHF, it doesn't take a whole lot of turns, even at a kilowatt of power. And the size gauge of wires I'm using are a heck of a lot bigger than the gauge of wires you're talking about. They're, you know, I'm using up to like 10 and 12 gauge wire inside this thing, and then terminating into, the hardest part is getting it mechanically inside so that you can get the connectors terminated on the coil as close to, but sometimes it takes little bars running over the top of the coil so that you can locate the connector on the right edge. It's kind of a little bit of a mechanical issue, but it's neither a toroid, an E-core, or anything like that. What I'm actually using is something very similar to what you were describing. Now, I'm using bars that are ground into like round, it looks like almost like a dowel in length, almost like a ferrite rod, except, you know, it's a round diameter. And then what I do is I use square material in the corners and basically enclose the field. So I'm building the coil form on top of the rounded section of the ferrite. And what I do is I do not bifile or wind or twist the windings together at all. I space them. And what I do is I wind the primary winding as like an open coil. And then in between the other coil, in the inside spacing, so first thing I'll do is I'll anchor the first coil. I'll get that one anchored and either RTV down, glued down, epoxy, so it doesn't move. Then I'll mount the other coil in between the windings on the same flux layer, because the lines of flux are going to run perpendicular to the coil. So you have to make sure that those wires don't touch each other and the coils are spaced far enough in between. Wind the next one on top of it, and then fix it. And now the hard part is bending or terminating the wires around the outside to add the primary and the secondary connectors. You follow me so far, Dick? KC2QIQ.
I think I almost do. The primary winding, I think you wound it with a right number of turns on the bobbin, which is on top of the ferrite round rod, and you space the turns more than wire diameter. So if the space between the turns is greater than wire diameter, and we call that primary your red enameled wire, 10 gauge or whatever, and you anchor the two ends, then you take what you call the secondary and wind it into the spaces that you created in that primary winding. So now you get the best possible flux coupling between primary and secondary, but in theory the least amount of capacitance between the two. Is that sort of what you've done, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes, that's exactly it, Dick. And as I said, the hard part, in other words, once this thing is the primary and the secondary and the connectors are wound, then it's really simple to close the ferrite part of the loop. In other words, close the loop of the toroid. In other words, because now you can take blocks of ferrite and cap the ends and then just bring it around on the other side just to cap the ferrite, just to close the magnetic field link, because you don't want to have that as an open air core. You want to close up that magnetic field around the outside. But as long as the winding is spaced off the core, you don't want any connection to any mechanical or electrical connection anywhere near the ferrite material itself. You want to actually lift the diameter off. So you need some kind of a dielectric coil form between the ferrite and where you start that winding, and something that's precision that won't move, because any drifting or moving of that coil along the ferrite is going to give you all kinds of crazy response. So you have to have a piece of dielectric Teflon. If you can drill out Teflon and slide a Teflon tube over the top of the ferrite, round ferrite, and then basically create your winding on top of that, and then epoxy it to the ferrite, and then put space in between the other winding, and then the key part is attaching the connectors around the outside in order to get the match and adjusting the number of turns. But with some experimentation, you can see that the results are very fruitful.
Yeah, you've got a good invention there, Glenn. By spacing it with what you said, the Teflon tubing, the wire itself is not super close to the ferrite, therefore it is not capacitively loaded by the ferrite, and you don't get that loss phenomenon. But yet, magnetically, the ferrite is still going down the center, and by if you complete the windings, you then added more ferrite on the ends and closed the loop. So in other words, I guess in cross-section it would be a square ferrite device where only the winding is on one leg of the square. That's one way you could have done it. If you had the right diameter size of toroid ferrite, and if you had the right kind of a bobbin material in the ferrite, could this primary and secondary winding, with the right amount of spacing, been wound around a round toroid? And I wonder if you consider that, Glenn, because that way the magnetic path would be closed a little bit more succinctly. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I've been there, done that. That doesn't work. And the reasoning it doesn't work is because you wind up with dissimilar spacing from the inside diameter to the outside diameter, because the inside of the hole of your ferrite, or, you know, you could actually epoxy coat a piece of toroid, any kind of a toroid, and get a thick enough dielectric coating around the outside so that you could basically space the wire well off the ferrite material in a toroid form. And then, of course, if you pick the correct diameter and cross-sectional area, you could size it for the power that you wanted to do, as long as you get enough turns. And it would be mechanically nice, because then the connectors would all wind up on one end. So that was, you know, the low-hanging fruit mechanically, to try to start that way first. But the thing that bites you in that type of geometry, when you're trying to design the coil and the coupling, is that what happens at RF frequencies, now, granted, it's the cat's meow below 10 megahertz. So you want to build toroids down below 10 megahertz, go right ahead. VHF and going up, like when you were at 900 meg, forget about it, because what you're having is one side of your coil diameter is really going to be short on one side, and the other side, the geometry of the spacing is going to be very, very wide. And maybe it can be done, but with the wire diameters and the power I was trying to run through there, I couldn't get the results I was looking for.
Okay, you're running at 2 gigs, and you're running what, like 100 watts through this thing, Glenn? Go ahead.
I was trying a couple of different load pulls and different loads. Like I would take a 50 ohm, you know, bird loads, and I would try 50 ohm. And, you know, at first I tried 1 to 1, 2 to 1, 3 to 1, and 4 to 1, using up the 4 loads in series, and then I tried the parallel arrangement, you know, by paralleling them with keys going in the other direction. And, you know, basically just trying to get everything together with keys using, you know, PL259 UHF connectors initially, you know, just to try to do load pulls from, you know, going from like 200 ohms and then down to like, you know, 12 and a half ohms, you know, and adjusting either way and adjusting the turns on these things. And the type of generator I was using was one of those EIL lab amplifiers, and I was using power up to 1 kilowatt, Dick.
And I think you said you were getting an eighth of a dB of insertion loss. Fantastic. The way you wound the thing, with enough turns, you were putting very little flux into the coil and into the ferrite, and just the primary and secondary connection directly was doing the work. You also, I think, could have twisted the two wires together if it came close to the right impedance, and then wound the twisted pair onto your ferrite, and come closer to the floating, what do you call it now, current bound that I used, that I described to you earlier. That is a mini-circuit product. Okay. What do you believe is your common mode impedance of your... In other words, when you built this thing in one-to-one, you would have, say, for instance, 50 ohms in and 50 ohms out. And you could, in theory, put a 50-ohm floating resistor on the output, not at high power, just to do a test, and then measure what is your common mode impedance to ground when one lead of the primary is grounded. What do you believe was your common mode impedance when the differential was made one-to-one? Back to you, Glenn.
It's not a measurement that I can give you, like, with data, but I can tell you something empirically from the measurements that I've made so far. And it's using, you know, different... It was once I pulled it off and I went back to the network analyzer and started measuring that way, from the power measurements. I think initially I told you, not only can I do 1-to-1, I can do 1-to-1, 2-to-1, up to 4-to-1, and in either direction, 200 ohms down to 12.5. So depending on how I wind these ratios, I can adjust it going up and down either way. So I would imagine that because from that information that I was able to wind it either 4-to-1, up to 4-to-1 in either direction, that the factor of impedance difference that of isolation that I was seeing at, you know, frequencies in VHF and UHF. I can't speak too much about microwave because the equipment I was using didn't go much above 1 gig as far as the network analyzers go. But I would say in VHF and UHF, my isolation probably had to be at least 10 times a 4-to-1 mismatch. So in other words, let's say 10 times 4-to-1 up. So, you know, say 10 times 1, so say 4K ohms with respect to any plane around the deck.
Fantastic. So your primary was wound with enough space between the turns that you could wind the secondary between those. And I presume when you wanted a 4-to-1, you would wind the primary the same way and only use a small number of turns in the middle of the all of the turns of the primary. You only put a small number of turns interstitially there. And when the turns ratio were 2-to-1, your impedance ratio was 4-to-1. Is that about the way you did it, Glenn? Go ahead.
That's exactly it, Dick, and it works just like that. It's amazing. Follows Lynn's law to the T. And the other thing that's beautiful about it is, the hardest part, this whole construction, isn't winding it on the coil form, getting the dielectric across the outside, epoxying the leads in. The hard part is attaching the connectors without too much stray length. What I actually had to do was try to construct, in other words, I can solder the center lead of a connector mechanically to one end of the coil on either side, and I try to oppose it on either end. And then the difficult part is trying to bridge. So in other words, like if I want to do, let's say, a 4-to-1, the best way to do it is to use two connectors. In other words, use the 50-ohm connector on one side for the 50-ohm side, and then if I want to go up in impedance, is to use two connectors, and then basically attach the coil across the two centers of the connectors on the outside. You follow what I'm saying? And then try to bridge and connect the two connectors with the case on the outside as the common mode connection, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, with a nice shielded case, I can see how that can work pretty well. Also, by the way, had you wound all of this on a toroid, and you make the center of the toroid, the wire spacing, greater than wire diameter, and the fact that there's excess spacing on the outer circumference of the toroid is not necessarily bad. The way the magnetic field will form itself there, the extra spacing on the outer perimeter of the toroid versus the inner circle may not be bad. I'm a little bit amazed why, if you had the right ferrite material and enough turns, why the toroid version of this didn't work. And like you said, the nice thing about the toroid version is that the beginning and the end come out in the same place, like 12 o'clock on the circle, so to speak, and therefore lead length is very easy to do. I'm still amazed that the toroid didn't work, whereas the linear solenoid version with extra chunks of ferrite plugged in later on, completing the pass, did it. And by the way, if you didn't complete the magnetic pass, I'll bet you the difference wouldn't be great. Back to you, Glenn.
Well, if you don't complete the magnetic pass, forget about trying to put it in the metal box, because what will happen is the minute you try to put it in a metal box, in, all your measurements just go zooey and everything goes off scale, and because the field now is shooting out of either end of the ferrite, so you can't put it inside an enclosed area, and the insertion loss goes all over the place, and you can't run your hand next to it, put it next to a piece of metal, or do anything. So you got to cap the ends in order to keep everything uniform. The other thing is with the toroids, yeah, you can turn, you can adjust the turns, you can get it to work, and it'll look okay. You put on a network analyzer at low power, and you'll see, yeah, hey, look, I hit a home run here. And then try to run some power through it, and you'll start seeing one side of the core start heating up, and then when you try to do a frequency sweep on it, you'll see, like, you got, like, this ripple that's running up and down all over the, yuck. KC2QIQ. Those are my problems in experience.
When you built the toroid version, Glenn, were you able to get the same amount of ferrite cross-section of the same kind of ferrite material as your solenoid version with magnetic closing on the ends? Were you able to get the same cross-section of the same kind of ferrite?
Oh, absolutely. Dick, and I'm telling you, the funny part about it is once you get below 10 megahertz, everything is easy. It's when you start getting into, like, VHF and UHF, that's when everything starts coming apart, that for some reason, everything wants, all those windings want to be super uniform. And you don't even want to have, like when you're doing this, you almost want to take, like, put, like, a small routing into the Teflon a little bit, so that when you do your spacing of your coil going down, that one end of the coil form spacing is perfectly linear going all the way down, so that it's matched from one end to the other side. And when you put the one in between, you want to kind of do the same thing. Any kind of non-uniformity inside the spacing in VHF and UHF, well, the first thing you notice when you start doing, like, a frequency sweep on a spectrum analyzer, you'll see all kinds of ripples up and down. You know, it's more than 3 dB of ripple in the passband.
Let me suggest something to you. If you could get a very large nylon screw with very coarse thread. No, that wouldn't do it. Because the threads all track. You'd have to, on a lathe, run the pitch of the threads such that there's really a primary and secondary thread, if you know what I mean. But if you made a screw-like device where the wire sat into the threads of a nylon screw, and the center of the nylon screw is drilled out, and that's where the ferrite goes, now it would guarantee the spacing of the wires all the way along. Everything would be uniform. In other words, I'm making a fancy coil form, and I bet you considered that. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been doing this now for a while, and I got like all kinds of little variations of it, all the way up to, and the beautiful part of that is when you do it mobile, that, I mean, it's like super-duper broadband, and the coupling connection to the antenna is really the only mismatch when you're connecting it, and you kind of like get the best broadband capabilities, and when you're mounting the magnetic mounted antennas on the outside of the car, super phenomenal, because when you lift the antenna off the car, by the time you put it down on the metal body, you hardly see any change in the match. You can get some really fantastic responses. And what I was experiencing here, they usually refer to that as a voltage-fed transformer, as opposed to like when you tie the auto transformer together. That's typically called, in transformer terminology, a current-fed transformer. So that's why when I opened up the box of the pre-manufactured, like MFJ, Ballin, or some of these other manufacturers, I was looking at their construction, and I didn't see all that isolation in there, and they were calling it a current-fit Ballin, and I was starting to get a little confused. That's why I just wanted to ask you to clarify. KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, the definition of a current-fit Ballin or a current Ballin that I gave you is mine and the way I'm using it, and is it universal to the industry? I'm not sure. The thing that amazes me is that Mini Circuits, among other companies, make a number of one-to-one Ballins. Nobody in his right mind is going to use a one-to-one, they call it a transformer. No one is going to use a one-to-one transformer. If the input impedance, the output impedance is identical, why are you using it? The only possible reason is you want common mode isolation between primary and secondary. So the amount of isolation at your operating frequency is important. That is not on the data sheet. They give you the swept S11 and the swept S22, the insertion loss versus frequency. They give you every parameter except the amount of balancing action. And the one-to-one transformer, the main thing you're using it for is to get balancing action, and they don't tell you. And I've been reporting that to the people who are acting as the vendors for these devices and recommending that they put the measurement on the data sheet. And I supplied the measurements that I made on my Rode and Schwartz network analyzer that's available to me. So I can tell it's an area that's only partially understood. I think there's not enough RF mavens asking these questions like the ones you and I are asking. Sounds like you've got a nice successful project there. And when you talk about a magnetic antenna for a car, is that a loop of wire? What is a magnetic antenna for an automobile look like, Glenn? I know what monopoles look like, but I'm not quite sure I know what a magnetic antenna for a car is. Go ahead.
Sorry, Dick, you got bitten by my slang. Magnetic mount. Basically, just, you know, I have like half wave at 144, quarter wave at 440, with a little choke in between, just to, you know, just to make the cutoff a little trap in between. So I have like broadband at half wave for 2 meters to cover all 2 meters. And broadband, you know, quarter wave match at 440, and the magnetic part is the mount that sticks to the body of the car, and I just happen to favor that. So when I come to a location, like a parking garage, and I just want to pop it off of the car real quick, the purpose of the Ballin in between, which normally isn't necessary, because you can kind of get the match broadband, you know, 2-to-1 VSWR, without any kind of Ballin in between. But the reason I created Ballin, put them in between, is because I can get matches that are far superior. I can start off at 1.1 to 1 at 146 and be no greater than 1.3 at 148 to 150, and down at the other end, I can go down as low as 136 with my MFJ antenna analyzer and still be no greater than 1.25 to 1. And the same thing at 440, just switch over to the other end, and with that very, very broadband coupling. And it doesn't necessarily have to be exactly 50 ohms. I kind of just tailor the turns exactly as I want them to get the exact match that I'm looking for. And there again, when I lift the magnetic mount off of the body of the car and I look at the impedance matches, putting it back down on the body, you don't see a whole heck of a lot of difference in match.
You know, Glenn, you've got a very useful device here in other places. Mel and I have been preaching the huge benefit that's possible with a full half-wave vertical dipole. And if you want to push it full half-wave, 5/8 wave, but a full vertical dipole fed from the bottom, from the ground end, the end closest to Mother Earth, would be an extremely high-performance antenna if you got a tree or a tower that's tall enough to mount the thing like Mel does in his front yard. With the mounting devices you're talking about, feeding it from the bottom would be easy. And the center insulator is not required. Just make it one solid piece of wire. And don't have to go through all the rigmarole of bringing the feed line, the coax cable or the twin lead, in the center of the dipole when it's vertically polarized and bringing it off at right angles, which is mechanically a pain. If you can feed the dipole from the bottom, life gets easy. And if you want the vertical half-wave dipole to, if you've got enough altitude, to have the whole thing raised in the air, so the bottom is not near Earth. And now you put an extra piece of wire down there, you could call it your tuned ground, so to speak, and with the proper kind of balancing devices and impedance matching, you can make all of this thing work like a charm. And so these guys who are building vertically polarized antennas in their backyard and laying down a zillion ground plane radials, none of that would be required if they were using these techniques. One simple spike in the ground at the bottom would be the ground, the counterpoise, the antenna itself half-wave and resonant at any altitude that you're capable of, and I suspect it would have a very low angle of radiation, very high efficiency, and very little material is required to do it once you solve the problem. And it would negate the problem we got right now, where every one of the training manuals we can get from any of our instruction books will show us a half-wave dipole always parallel to the ground. They never show the vertical half-wave dipole perpendicular to the ground. That whole antenna technology has never been properly investigated. See where I'm going here, Glenn? I think you've got a solution to a problem that people haven't even yet defined. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, I've been doing this for a little while, and I've been experimenting with all different things, and what's really key is the second part of what you said, the altitude issue. That's not so important as far as mounting at the ground level. I tried that. Yeah, you can get a grill match really easy, but the antenna doesn't work all that well. But once you start elevating the antenna off ground, in other words, and now you can feed it with a real piece of coax, granted, you're not going to have the greatest bandwidth, but certainly you're going to get a better match than just feeding a piece of coax at 75 ohms and trying to cut the antenna for a fixed length. Now the length isn't so critical anymore. You can kind of get a comfortable length and then adjust the balun match on the other side to give you the match that you're looking for, and then basically have everything adjusted, good VSWR match, run it down, and you can build them robust enough, especially down at the lower frequencies, where you can put a nice sizable amount of power in there. Just don't try to do it out of band, though. That's the only thing KC2QIQ.
Now, when you get a chance to see QEX, the December issue, and you see the way the guy is feeding the half-wave dipole that's part of a Yagi by way of snaking the coax cable through a hole in the side of the tubing, right in the center of the dipole, and now he makes that come out to one end of the dipole and he's off-center feeding the dipole. Techniques like that can also be used on this vertically polarized half-wave dipole or 5/8 wave dipole if you like, which is itself elevated above the ground. With these balancing devices that you're discussing, and with the understanding of choose the right place along the radiator where you get the impedance you want, feed it at that point. The fact that your transmission line ordinarily would be hot, but you've got a way of balancing it in a current balanced manner so that now the common mode impedance is high, and so therefore the current doesn't flow down the feed line into the shack on the outside. We can have our cake and eat it too. There's a whole class of antennas here left to be investigated. Hey, Mel, that catenary, that parabolic catenary you've got in made out of green wire in your in your front yard. I see the possibility that it can go into revision 3 and revision 4 with even higher performance yet. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yes, it's got possibilities. The problem would be then moving the feed point around. What I experimented with, you know, Glenn brought up a very good question there. He asked about the balance, both current and voltage balance. Now, today, you don't see, I don't think, too much advertised anymore in the choke type balance of a voltage type. You see only more or less current balance. However, I have built several voltage balance, and I found that in some cases it's an advantage because at the terminals of a voltage balance, you have equal and opposite voltages to be that appear at the two outputs. And this is desirable. Basically, some of my matching on these catenary systems is more like a voltage balance than a current balance, Dick, over.
Okay. If you've got a pure current-fed balance and you're willing to take the two differential output leads, ground one or put a certain impedance to ground at that one, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can force it to be a voltage balance, use it as a current balance, or halfway in between. You've got full freedom if you've got a pure current balance, B-A-L-U-N. Some people pronounce it as Baker, Alpha, Lima, November. Some people pronounce it Baker, Alpha, Lima, Mike. I think a balance is it's a contraction of balanced and unbalanced. B-A-L-U, November. A current balance, I think, gives you the greatest amount of flexibility. You can force it in many circumstances to be a voltage balance. In other words, the output voltages are defined with reference to ground. They're not floating. You can force that. But to have the freedom to off-center feed, I think can be kind of valuable. Let's see if we have anyone else who had questions that questions or comments. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
And 2APG, Dave and Yen.
Go right ahead, Dave.
Hi, Dick. Good evening to everybody. Quick question regarding radio-controlled wristwatch. Has that ever been discussed on the net before?
Okay. There are kinds of wristwatches you can buy these days which listen to, I think it's 60 kilohertz from WWVB, and I think they do that listening at the 3 o'clock in the morning and whatever, and therefore they align themselves with the National Institute of Science and Technology, I think it's called, NIST, and therefore your watch keeps extremely accurate time. Is that what you're referring to, Dave?
Correct.
Okay. I hear tell that some of these watches are not super expensive. Some people are very happy with the way they work. And so it's a little bit similar to what some of the guys are doing on 10 gigahertz. You go ahead and buy a real good, high quality, 0.05% or whatever it is, frequency accuracy, crystal from International Crystal or any other good company. And you buy a fifth overtone crystal for roughly 100 megacycles. Multiply it up all the way to 10,000 megacycles because it's the local oscillator for your crystal control down converter where you're making 10 gigahertz contacts with your buddies. Well, if you're not careful, you can easily have 30 and 40 kilohertz of frequency error between what you want and what you get. And particularly if it's a mobile rig and on a cold day you put it in your car, you drive it up to the top of the mountain, you turn it on and it's slowly warming up, and you're drifting all over the place. So, finding each other up there when you have as much as 30 kilohertz of frequency error, and you want to listen to the guy's weak CW to the nearest fraction of 1 kilohertz of frequency error, you're aiming the antenna, swishing back and forth, and you're sweeping the frequency, probability of intercept becomes a problem. So what these guys are doing is they're using a GPS disciplined oscillator. They take a global positioning satellite receiver system, listening to a satellite, which is very accurately transmitted by the government, and they use that as a frequency reference while they're in the field, and that in turn slowly operates their VCXO, in other words, voltage-controlled crystal oscillator, and so it forces their oscillator to have the exact accuracy, and they can get within 1 hertz at 10,000 megacycles. That's one part in 10 to the 10. And so those guys in California that are doing this, there's been lots of articles on the microwave reflector on this subject, and there's been even a few guys who have used broadcast stations, the 3.5 megacycle subcarrier for chrominance, the color portion of the color picture of a network program, also has very high accuracy, traceable all the way back to the Bureau of Standards. So by one means or another, in the field, you can be listening to something that's got frequency accuracy and force your system to be right on to the nearest hertz. And that makes a lot more long-range QSOs possible. So you could say this radio-controlled watch, as you call it, is a minor version of that. You are disciplining the oscillator inside of your watch to be aligned with the National Bureau of Standards, and I think that's taking place at 60 kilohertz. N2 APG, K2RIW.
Okay, here's the problem that I'm having. I have an analog wristwatch that's radio controlled at the 60 kilohertz frequency, WWBB, which worked fine till the battery went dead, and then it stopped working. So of course I replaced the battery, and since I replaced the battery, I haven't been able to get the wristwatch to show the correct time. Now it does have an indicator on it, which indicates whether or not it has received the signal overnight. And I get an indication that it has received the signal. The second hand appears to be accurate, right on the money. But the minutes and the hours is off. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. The instruction manual, unfortunately, is a little light when it comes to any troubleshooting and problems and stuff like that. They do tell you how to recalibrate the watch, which I've done. They tell you how to set the time zone, which I've done. But, you know, that's the problem I'm having. The watch appears to get the signal. The second hand appears to sync up perfectly, but the minutes and the hours are just way off.
With your manual control, are you able to force it into the right hours and the right minutes? Because I can see why one particular way you would set up the watch, if you were designing it, it would force the second hand to be accurate, because a good quartz watch these days, when I was carefully setting one 15 years ago, I could get it within better than a second per day. I think I could get it into 2 or 3 seconds of accuracy per week, as long as I kept wearing it and keeping it warm. So once you manually set the hours and minutes correctly, and if it properly keeps the seconds correctly after that, I think you've got it made. Are you telling me that when you force the right hours and minutes, and it selects the right seconds, that 24 hours later, it suddenly develops a great big error in the hours and minutes? Back to you, Dave.
Okay, there's no way to manually adjust the correct time. It sets it automatically according to the signal. So in other words, when I first put the battery in and the watch started to work, it had the incorrect time. So the procedure is for you to let it sit overnight and let it sync up with the signal overnight. So the next morning, I check the watch and I check the indicator to see whether or not it has synced up with the signal. I get a positive indication that the watch has synced up with the signal, has received the signal. I check the second hand. The second hand is right on the money. Now, in theory, the hours and the minutes should also be right on the money, but they're not. And it did work initially. So I'm kind of wondering, is it a propagation issue? Is my watch picking up a little bit of the signal, enough to sync the seconds, but not the minutes and the hours? Or what? You know, this is, you know, I don't think I'm doing anything wrong, but I'm a little perplexed as to why the watch would be supposedly receiving the signal, and the second hand is perfectly accurate, but not the hours and the minutes. That's confusing.
I've got a guess. When you plugged in the new battery and it started running for the first time,